Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel #LinuxShow. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. Want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out, www.linuxshow.com, for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
It's March 11th, 2003. Quickly looking at my calendar to determine the date. We're back. This is The Linux Show. This is our first show in March. We apologize to the regular listeners out there. The situation we were in last week was we were moving some stuff, or I should say Kevin was moving some stuff, and the phone company let him down. Like, that's new, huh? we did not get the remote facility in Geneva, Illinois.
North Aurora,
technically, okay. North Aurora, Illinois, set up in time to do the show last week, but we're back, bringing you the regular Tuesday night edition of The Linux Show. We've got most of the crew here with us. Kevin and I are here, of course, in Illinois. Out on the West Coast, we've got Arnie. Arnie, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, it's a beautiful day here in California, and doing great.
Well, that is good. How about you, Russ, on the opposite end?
It's actually been interesting because we had a warm weekend, and all this snow that looked like it was never going to go away, probably 75% of it disappeared in the space of 48 hours. So,
wow.
Things are looking up, and spring might actually be around the corner.
It's almost cherry tree time in Washington.
Well, that's the one thing that I heard that's gotten horribly screwed up through all this, is that the cherry tree festival is scheduled for the time when the blossoms are not expected to occur at all. Apparently, peak time is right after the festival is over, according to the new estimates, because of the strange cold that we've had this year. So, so if you come for the festival, you won't see the blossoms, or at least not in full bloom. But you might be able to still get good accommodations for the week after and see the whole thing for folks that are interested in such things.
Yeah. Well, did you happen to hear? I know it's kind of far away, but did you happen to hear a low rumbling on the southern horizon at about 4 o'clock this afternoon?
Not here.
Didn't hear it, huh?
Didn't notice it.
Okay, well, about 4 o'clock this afternoon, our government, in an attempt to scare the bejesus out of, I presume, Iraq, blew up the largest conventional weapon in history, of all places, in the panhandle of Florida.
Your heaven.
Blew up a bunch of swamp, I guess. But, they released videos of it this evening at about 6 o'clock Central Time. It was big explosion. So I was just wondering if there was any notations on the Richter scale that you might have felt vibration or something, because they said it felt like a nuclear bomb going off. So, anyways, well, let's go ahead and jump on into the first section of The Linux Show. While I'm attempting to track down Doc and Eric Raymond, I'll be sort of working in the background. So I guess what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand out the show to you, Russ, for a couple of minutes. Why don't you start out with your hot story of the week? Don't talk about SCO yet. We all have things to do to talk about SCO, but why don't you start us off with a couple of stories? And hopefully by that time I'll have lined Doc and Eric up.
Okie dokie. All the stories I'm talking about tonight are are on the Linux Show webpage for everyone who is on IRC. You can find the links there. The first one is we have labeled as FUD is apparently alive and well in India. And that was a story that Sean McHenry, one of our listeners, sent to us to take a look at about a week ago. And it's a very interesting little piece in that it really does look like it was written by a Microsoft employee. I mean, it's just that's just the way it reads. It talks about all the classic current Linux FUD that it lacks support, it lacks integration tools, it can't get support from local service providers, and when it comes down to it, you know, that must mean that a Microsoft solution is better, cheaper, yada, 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 yada. So it's just an interesting piece, rather clear that that there is the move afoot, regardless of what Microsoft may be saying in its public statements, to try to dispel the notion that that Linux is real competition for it. So it's an interesting little piece from that regard. I don't know if anyone has any comment on that.
Well, of course, then there's always the article. Let's see, I think there's, you'll find it on a couple of regular link sites that Microsoft is also, at the same time, speaking out of the outside of their mouth and saying that Linux isn't a threat.
Right.
And of course, if that's true, why are they spending so much time trying to warn everybody about the grave threat of open source software?
There was an interesting talk back over at Linux Today on that particular article, Arnie, that I found very interesting, and they said that therefore, logically, if what Microsoft is saying is true, that Linux is not a threat to Windows, then Windows cannot be a threat to Unix. Because if Windows is trying to take the Unix business and Linux is getting it instead, that, sorry, is a threat to Windows. So if Microsoft is to be believed, then we also must believe that Microsoft is not seeking to take Unix business away, which is something that I don't know anyone who believes that story. But I found that a very interesting talk back over there at Linux Today attached to that story. There's a couple other, I just want to get a couple quickies in here, too, for people who are interested. One of them is the link on the webpage for the PHP Quebec conference up in Canada. It's the March 20th and 21st. So for folks inside the Great White Northlands up there, if PHP is your thing, you may want to look into that. And one link that isn't out there is that there is a Python conference in Washington, D.C. the week after. I think it's the 27th and 28th. And it's called PyCon. So you know, if you have a language of choice here, folks, for getting work done, here's your chance at the end of this month to go and talk with other people about it, which is pretty neat stuff.
Well, while we're talking about conferences, I'll throw this one in here too, so I don't forget. I just got a notification late this afternoon, just a few minutes before showtime, that there's going to be a new conference primarily for educators called Linux in Education, the spring conference. This is the first of supposedly a series, held April the 5th, 2003. The theme is Discovering Free Software for Our Schools. Facing technology bugs and cuts without fear. Great concept. The information on the concept, on the event, can be found at the website www.hagle.com. And the fee is $5 for a registration fee if you register in advance. It's $20 if you register at the door. What they're really hoping that people will do is just go to PayPal and register and throw $5 into the kitty, whether you're going or not. And this will help fund similar events around the country, hopefully. But Go ahead and go to the website, Hagle.com, and there's information for the Linux and Education Spring Conference. The list of speakers and events actually looks very, very good. I looked it over quickly before the show. So, any more, Russ?
Yeah, a couple others. One is over at searchenterpriselinux.com, which I think is the first time that we've referenced this site. This site apparently just came online in the last couple of weeks. And it's called Analyst Recognizes Linux on Most Enterprise Agendas. And it's talking with Dan Kuznetsky of National Data Corp. There for people who are used to listening to the Linux show, there's no really relations here. But I think it is a good thing for people who are trying to essentially sell Linux into enterprises to find out what IDC is saying, because there are a lot of businesses that listen to IDC and some of these other analyst groups. So it would be useful to have this bookmarked if it will work in your place of work, and also just to be aware of what analysts are now telling management these days. So it's worth the read for sure, especially if you're trying to get...
Hi, this is Doc. I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Thank you, Doc.
Hello, Doc. This is the Linux show calling. Sorry about that, Russ. That just popped out of nowhere. I don't know where that came from.
Well, it's good to know that Doc's here in spirit anyway. And the last one here is a piece called 2003 and Beyond. And this this was featured in a number of the Linux websites in the last couple of weeks. It is it's a very interesting paper. Once again, for people who are in the open source area, there isn't much in the way of really stunning revelations, but it is really terrific to see all of this information in one central place. And you know, it's a long read, folks, you know, compared to what we're used to on,
it's way too long.
Yeah, but it's a very nice resource paper as far as I'm concerned, and that is that if you're finding yourself debating various aspects of open source and Linux with different people, having this thing with you so you can, you know, basically, if nothing else, check the footnotes so you can get the references for all these things in one place, it's very useful. So I think it's worth at least a check over, and bookmark it on your browser if you need to find some links in a hurry.
Well, I will go along with you. It's probably a useful resource for the uninitiated and the patient.
People who are working with the uninitiated.
Yeah, people who are working with the uninitiated, people who have very deep waiting boots. But for people who are really informed with the issues, I mean, how many sentences does it really take to say Microsoft sucks? I mean, okay. But no, it was a very well done piece. If you were writing for academia, that's what this would really be for. Would be for the kind of thing that academia would be looking for, very, very long on detail, and well sourced, actually.
That's, yeah,
one thing that the guy did a good job on.
I've seen this guy at the Linux World Expo, I think. He looks familiar.
Could be. Don't know.
His name is Andrew Grigas.
Yes. Yes, and so
but the face, these pictures on the top of the page.
I have been getting emails about this article for the last 2 weeks from people all over the world telling me, you got to read this. This guy's the next, he's the open source equivalent of Nostradamus. So I had to. I was literally.
Almost every paragraph is footnoted.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it? It's very detailed. The guy must have been a teacher sometime in his life. But anyways, any more stories for us?
I think that's more than enough from me for right now.
Okay. Kevin, do you have any new releases this week?
No new releases, but quick note that it looks like McDonald's is experimenting with wireless access, and they will be providing an hour of wireless access with a combo meal, so that could be interesting.
Well, I have, interestingly enough, I have been contacted because of, you know, our Save the Linux Show DSL partnership that we posted up 2 weeks ago. Ironically, I've been contacted by like six different people who are representing various chains of restaurants that are all investigating doing free Wi-Fi.
Mm.
And apparently Panera Bread, which is a restaurant at least here in the Midwest, I don't know if it's all across the country or not, but here in the Midwest, they have had a very successful test of putting Wi-Fi in their restaurants. By putting the Wi-Fi in, they are have increased their holding capacity. They really haven't, you know, the people who come in to eat lunch haven't increased, but what they're doing is they're getting people in the morning that stay for a few hours.
You have reached the maximum time permitted for recording your message. If you are satisfied with your message, press 1. To listen to your message, press 2. To erase and re-record, press 3.
And another source for the Linux Show, if you want to download it, is on Dot Voicemail.
You have reached the maximum time permitted for recording your message. If you are satisfied with your message, press 1. To listen to your message, press 2. To erase and re-record, press 3.
So
you want to press 1?
No, I just kicked it off.
Okay.
There it goes.
Okay.
Well, Doc can enjoy that later.
Boy. But getting back to that Kevin, that's really amazing, because I think people are going to start doing that right and left. I think we're going to have a wired restaurant world. I think the Celex and the phone companies have made a serious mistake in trying to squeeze every dime of monopoly money they can out of the public, and there's going to be an explosion of hotspots now. It's just going to be incredible. I really believe this is going to happen. Thank goodness. Maybe we'll just be hanging out at restaurants for our internet and just screw the cable companies altogether. But okay, Arnie, do you have any stories of the week that are new?
I've got a couple of things, but boy, that SCO versus IBM lawsuit has just really gobbled up a lot of the news. There's really not, you know, you go to the link sites. But I've got a couple items. There's one, there's a new product called SQL Desktop, a new Office Productivity Tool for the Linux Desktop, which is apparently free download, runs on Windows or Linux. It apparently is one of these little simple database tools, and that is on OSForge.com. It's one of the news stories today. And it's called SQL Desktop, a new Office Productivity Tool for the Linux Desktop. People who are interested in that might want to take a look at that. And also on OSForge, there's a story, Linux Center Up with Government's Nod. And now this one is really cool, and we might that apparently the Chinese government is
welcome to Verizon's voice messaging. To enter your mailbox, press star. Otherwise, please redial the number you are calling, starting with the area code.
Is it dead?
To enter your mailbox, press star.
Otherwise, please redial the number you are calling, starting with the area code.
Yeah, right.
This is just utterly bizarre.
To enter your mailbox, star. Otherwise, please redial the number you are calling, starting with the area code.
Utterly bizarre.
Okay. Well, apparently the Chinese government is with the auspices of IBM, backed by IBM Linux engineers, developing an infrastructure and technologies to bring Linux to the forefront, backed by the Chinese government. And I guess it was an opening ceremony with more than 30 government officials were present, and Vice Mayor of Beijing, and Deputy Director of the Ministry of Information Industry were present at this big unveiling. This, of course, came on the heels of a letter of intent signed by the Beijing government and IBM last fall, and that's kind of an interesting thing. We've talked about the Chinese, Indian governments both, you know, getting connected with Linux for some time now, and it's nice to see that some of these things have come to fruition. Another, I've got two clueless pundits for this week. Neither one are really entirely clueless, but they deserve comment. On VNUnet, Guy Cuny from IT Week has a comment: Linux zealots lean on desktops, and of course he claims that one of these people that claims that that Linux word processors aren't up to snuff. You need to run Word or something like that, and that without Word, that Linux isn't going to go very far.
That's accurate, circa year 2000.
Yeah. I mean, he's a little bit behind him, but he seems to be a fairly well-reasoned guy. This other guy from the Chicago Tribune, by the way, registration required, Michael James from the Baltimore Sun, but it's being published in the Chicago Tribune, and you'll see links to it at the various Linux link sites. Goes a little bit further. Linux options still boxed in, and he comes right out and says it. Yeah, he's talking about his whole premise here is to evaluate the various ways to run Windows software on Linux. And I must agree with him. As long as you define Linux value as quote, ability to run Windows software, unquote, you're going to come to the conclusion that Linux is boxed in and it's not ready for prime time. However, we all know otherwise, and that there's real true products available for Linux. He also complains a bit about installation being difficult, and of course, if you buy a PC with Linux on it, or if you could buy a PC with Linux on it, the installation, like Windows, the installation isn't an issue. But that's on the Chicago Tribune site, and you can see links to it at various places. And this is, while the Linux scene is looking better, it's still got a way to go, well, mainly because it doesn't run these nice office suites from Windows. I mean, you know, of course, we got our own office suite.
Yep. Speaking of which, I finally, we did the interview, 2 weeks ago for LaCouris?
Mm-hmm.
Did the interview with them 2 weeks ago. Just got the box in the mail with not only the new version of their desktop OX desktop program, but also their office productivity pack. And so far, my daughter has gotten it half loaded, the first of two product. And we're going to be working on the office productivity pack probably tomorrow night, and hopefully I'm going to get a chance for both her, being a 12-year-old, and myself to work with the LaCouris product and give you the perspective from my 12-year-old. I thought that would be an interesting way to take the approach. Because if a 12-year-old could do it, just about anybody can do it.
Yeah.
The rest of my stories are all SCO. And
let's go ahead and get into SCO. I've tried to get both Doc and Eric. For some reason, their phone systems are not letting us through.
Oh, no.
A conspiracy. Aha.
And, well, Doc's probably still in the air, is my guess.
Right.
So we'll excuse him. He was supposed to be landing. I'm going to go look at the clock. He was supposed to land about 10 minutes ago. So we'll try and pick him up again a little later. But don't know where Eric is. I'll try him again in a few minutes. But let's go ahead and start with the SCO story. Arnie, you're talking already, so why don't you go ahead and start it. Why don't we try to address some of the stuff that's been going on in sort of a chronological order. That's really why I wanted Eric here on the show this week, because he was like the first one to hear about this, because someone from inside SCO, I guess, leaked it to him. But he knew about it 24, 48 hours before it hit the press. And so that's why his nice long piece was so carefully prepared, because he had written it ahead of time and handed it off to Linux Today prior to the press release. So it's nice to have friends in high places, I guess. It was a great scoop for Eric. But hello?
Hello.
Eric. Speak yourself.
I'm sorry, this is Rob Lanfear.
Oh, Rob. Oh, excuse me. Rob, we're still in segment number two, so you can hang out and talk about segment number two if you'd like to, or just sit back and listen while we cover the SCO story. For those of you listening, this is Rob. He's our guest in the next segment when we're going to be talking about Helix. So welcome, Rob. Just hang out.
Thank you.
Hang out while we talk about SCO. So Arnie, take the story and run with it.
Okay, good. Well, apparently a Santa Cruz operation, a.k.a. formerly known as Caldera, a former Linux company, and I say former Linux company because with this lawsuit it's apparent that they're no longer a Linux company in any way, shape, or form. But if you want to read about this, I'm going to give you two very good, in addition to Eric, the article mentioned by Jeff, by Eric Raymond. There is Linux World Linux Weekly News .net, LWN.net. There is a look at the SCO complaint, and that is a fairly good summary of what the complaint is, characterization of the complaint. Eric Raymond's article is definitive, but then there's this other article which is really excellent on the Linux World site by Joe Barr, who, by the way, is hanging out in the chat room right this very minute. And the article's title is SCO's Lawsuit is Funny but Not Ha-Ha Funny. And I highly recommend that one, that article, to basically, without using a lot of legalese, read that one to get an idea of what's going on. Joe apparently has interviewed Peter Salas and a few other people and got information about the lawsuit. Another one that's kind of funny is Linux the Movie on the Micro the Inquirer website, and what they're pitching is the little link that was appeared on Slashdot earlier in the week, of a 3D animation of Linux source code development. And this article is recommending that people go ahead and that SCO maybe should go over and look at this 3D animation of Linux source code development and explain how their claims for that Linux was birthed from their own intellectual property based on the animation. And of course, the animation is very, very tree-like and very, very fragmented. And of course, you can't tell. There's no local development. It's all the development, like on a tree, is all at the leaves, not at the root. and it's kind of interesting.
Well, let's back you up a little bit, Artie.
Well, go ahead. You go ahead. Lead into it, Jeff. Okay. You've read the complaint.
Well, that's my first question to you, and because I've been monitoring the IRC without really saying much because I wanted people to sort of voice their opinions freely and not have them tainted with my sour attitude on this whole story.
Well, wait until they hear my sour attitude.
But I'm seeing very few people who are commenting in most of the press who have actually looked at the complaint. That's why some of these articles, like the ones at Linux Weekly News, are so refreshing. It's because they actually did look at the complaint. But
I have honestly not read the complaint.
Well, I have. You know what? I have.
Yeah, that's good.
And other than the fact that, number one, I agree with you that SCO probably ended any possible future they ever would have of ever being associated as a trusted member of an open source development, Linux or other, okay? You know, that's number one. I think that they have created an environment with this action where no one will ever trust them again. So for all intents and purposes, I think your assessment and the assessment of others is probably correct. They are no longer, you know, they've showed their hand and they're no longer a Linux company. And so that's probably a de facto truthful statement. But, you know, I've read that complaint over and over and over and over again, and it is an argument based solely upon intellectual property and work product and IBM, and has almost nothing to do with Linux whatsoever. Linux just happens to be the argument that SCO is using. And that, I think a lot of the reason why people are so upset is because this argument paints Linux as a product and the Linux community collectively as a developer community as a bunch of children incapable and incompetent to be able to produce a quality product without the help of companies like IBM, yada, yada, yada. So I think that tone has really set people off to the point that they're really not looking at the real content of the complaint. But there's nothing in this complaint stating that they're laying claim to Linux. It's not there. And if it is there, I wish somebody would point it out to me.
Well, I don't think this complaint is, but it certainly lays the groundwork. If they were to succeed in this, it would lay the groundwork to try to say that that there is intellectual property in Linux, which belongs.
Or Unix.
So.
The argument is intellectual property of Unix.
Yes, but it's the intellectual property of Unix that was taken by IBM and applied to Linux. And as such, that intellectual property, the logical conclusion, if this were to carry through, that intellectual property still belongs to SCO.
The way I read it the way I read it, maybe let's see if my characterization jives with yours, Russ.
Mm-hmm.
The way I understand the complaint is that IBM had access to the intellectual property of Unix in their development of AIX. And therefore, because they are also adding value-added intellectual property to Linux, they must necessarily be transporting their IP from Unix to
Linux.
Well,
there's more to it, because they cite Project Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
And people who might remember, Project Monterey was supposed to be this consortium to make the next great Unix for the IA64 architecture. And it was originally supposed to be SCO, the original SCO, Santa Cruz. It was supposed to be IBM, and I forget what the third one was. But the third company, was it Sequent? I don't remember. But the third company was, as I recall, was basically bought by IBM. SCO maintains that that they came very close to having an operable product when IBM said Monterey is hereby closed. It's a non-existent beast. We're not going to follow through. The argument, as I recall, was that IBM had no Intel, and I think it counts, shouts it out as being Intel-based architecture knowledge, and that SCO basically gave it to them as part of the Monterey effort, and therefore anything that IBM has done with Linux on Intel is because of SCO and SCO's intellectual property.
That kind of flies in the face of facts that, for instance, OS 2 was co-developed by Microsoft and IBM, and of course OS 2 is clearly an Intel.
And the other thing, quite frankly, is that IA64 is not IA32.
And also the fact that flies in the fact of that IBM was the originator of the PC architecture in the first place.
Well, Arnie, that's why what you've just hit on is probably, again, this is my opinion, a far more important real issue here than people getting upset and worried about, SCO's going after Linux. Just because somebody makes a claim, they file a suit and make a claim, doesn't make it so. Okay? There are two things within a legal complaint. One of them is assertions. The other part are facts that support the assertions. You have to show a factual behavior that had impact on something to do with your company. And in the case of this particular case, SCO is asserting that the handing of their IP, the Linux community, devalued Unixware. That's their assertion. But the fact is exactly what you said. IBM has plenty of previous Intel experience. There's also other facts that, of course, are not in the document, and it's probably part of the reason why Joe Barr was interviewing a guy like Peter Salas, because there is a deep and rich history of copywritten material from the public that has been added to Unix. And so SCO is potentially opening up a can of worms of if they are going to point the intellectual property finger at IBM, they may well have developers that 25 years ago allowed SCO, the original SCO, to utilize their code, and that may come back to haunt them. This is a very convoluted historical trail to prove fact, and I just see no way, no possible way of them actually being able to prove these assertions, because right now I don't see any facts in the document. I just see assertions.
One of the things that really gets me about this thing, and yeah, there's a lot of creative history going on here, I mean big time, but one of the assertions was that prior to IBM's activities, Unix was a dominant and marketable entity, and that as a result of IBM's,
right?
Excuse me.
So SCO is on the verge of bankruptcy. That's beside the point.
Yeah, that's it. That IBM has harmed the value of Unix, and the thing that I remember so clearly, having worked with DEC in the past, was that it was in the mid-90s, I think, when the message was going out loud and clear from just about every analyst on the freaking planet that Unix was dead. Unix was passé. It was time to get on to the Windows NT and all these other things that were coming down from Microsoft. So you put your transition plans in place now to get ahead of the curve, guys. And that was the message, you know, in the mid-90s. And what killed that message, frankly, was Linux, free software, open source, all coming to the fore and suddenly reversing the death spiral of Unix. Because suddenly there was new life, there was reason to stay with Unix if you had Unix, because here was this up-and-coming thing which was, you know, essentially Unix and played very well with traditional Unix. And so, you know, I would argue greatly that the value of Unix in a lot of ways has increased since the timeline that they cite. But the other thing that strikes me is that if SCO happens to be successful, they will probably do more to hurt the value of Unix than anything before. Because, quite frankly, I mean, let's think about this. If they manage to leverage IBM so that they can, say, destroy AIX, the thought that's going to go through the mind of most corporate management is, if they went for IBM, next they'll go for Sun, next they'll go for some of these other ones, and they'll probably come up with something. So I'm going to get the hell out now. And they will actually, if they succeed, which I think is, you know, about the chance of a snowball in hell, but if they were to succeed with this, I think they would actually destroy the remaining value of the Unix trademark.
You really think that it's going to affect Unix in that?
If it were to succeed, and I really, you know, I don't give it much there unless they got some, you know, a pile of smoking guns in the back room somewhere that they haven't carted out yet. But I think it would damage immensely the Unix trademark, because I think most other Unix entries would be looked at with suspicion by the corporate world, and that would motivate people to move away. And quite frankly, they ain't going to move away to SCO Unix. It ain't going to happen. So what would happen would be that you'd have people fleeing from all of the traditional Unix world. It would harm everyone on this side of the coin. It is one of the, if it were to succeed, it would be one of the stupidest moves imaginable, because it would give a bunch of money to the company as it then plunges into its final death spiral. You know, I mean, it is not it's not a long-term move. That's why I tend to agree with some people like Bruce Perens.
I don't agree with you at all. I think it could be a very long-term move. Like, look at Intergraph. They Intergraph has been making a couple $100 million a year off of suing people, whereas the actual product that they sell, they're selling, you know, a few million dollars a year worth of product to people who have old legacy Intergraph systems, you know, kicking around out there, old big CAD or mapping systems. But Intergraph is just sitting back and suing people right and left. Every time they write a little piece of CAD or mapping code, they have their attorneys go after them and try and find a line of code that is similar to their code, and then they sue. And they have literally been making, you know, a couple $100 million a year for the last 10 years just doing that.
Yeah, well, frankly, that would have to be their new business line.
Well, you know what? I think it may be.
Because the possibility would be like Bruce Perens and some others have said, that this is basically a play for an end game,
an exit strategy.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it's a 50-50 play. I think it is an exit strategy. I completely agree with that. But in the advent that there are no buyers, the guys who presently are in control of SCO are venture capitalists.
Yep.
They don't give a damn about the IT business. They're in the venture capital business.
That's all
they care about is money coming in.
That's it.
They have to sue a bunch of IT companies to get that money. They don't care. You know, they don't care who they hurt. They could care less.
Yep.
And so I could see very easily this company turning into a very litigious, non-productive member of the IT community. And that is unless they do a very, very rapid 180, which I don't see happening at this point. But any other angles you got on this one?
That's pretty much it for me.
Well, I think Linus basically hit the nail on the head in that it's not going to be a matter of hill of beans to IBM. It's a nuisance to them, undoubtedly, but Linux isn't going to be hurt by it. None of the developers on the kernel are in any way fazed by the lawsuit. And they're really not too concerned. He says he's too busy doing kernel.
Well, here's the irony in all this. And let's go ahead and wrap this up pretty quick so get on to our next segment. But there is a lot of irony here that's worth mentioning. A very, very short, 2.5 years ago, a relatively cash snuff Caldera, which had just gone through, number one, a successful second round of financing, and number two, had won a substantial lawsuit from Microsoft on the DR-DOS issue to the point that they spun spun their embedded Linux group off, and the name of that embedded Linux group skips my mind right at the moment. You remember what it is, Russ?
I'm trying to think what you're...
The embedded Linux.
Linux. Okay, so they're relative. A few years ago, they're relatively, cash snuff. I mean, Linux was for a while winning the embedded battle. They were doing real well. They fell apart in a hurry, but a couple years ago, this relatively reasonably successful, well organized Linux company was able to buy a failing, bankrupt Unix company and merge their products together. And whatever you want to call it, the bad management over the subsequent 2 years, when all of that money was burned and churned away, they attempted to turn to that previously bankrupt Unix company to try and save the thing that had really made Caldera a company, and that was being a Linux company. And so now they've gone through this very, very sad turn of events of saving this Unix company from itself, and now they've fallen into the relative trash heap of history that they've relegated their own position to just sitting on the sidelines of IT history being a footnote rather than potentially a leader that they could have been. And if, this company has only made traditionally one mistake, and they've made the same damn mistake over and over and over and over again.
They've learned by their mistake, and they can repeat it exactly.
They repeat it perfectly.
I would characterize it this way, Jeff, that they've taken, like you said, a bankrupt Unix company, and they bought them, and then they've done with every asset they have, attempted to morph themselves into that bankrupt Unix company.
Yeah. Well, and there's some chatter going on, Red Hat should buy SCO. You know what? At this time, here's what I think would be really, really cool. I think it would be really cool, because it's inevitable, SCO's going to fail, okay? They're not, I mean, IBM's got to have, like, what, $7 billion in their legal war chest? Come on! They're never going to win against IBM. IBM will delay it for a decade, and they will eventually die. But anyways, point being, it would be really very cool if a company like IBM would step up and purchase the assets, the Unix assets. Not SCO, the company, but the Unix asset, and donate it to the Free Software Foundation. I think that would be an end-all, total solution to killing this issue once and for all, and it would go away, and Unix would then be forever free. And I got a feeling that in another 12 months, that Unix property is not going to be all that expensive, because Caldera didn't pay very much for it at the time that they bought SCO. I think they paid, it was a very small amount of money. It was double-digit millions. It wasn't very much money at all compared to the history of the product. But I think that would be a great solution. Well, if there's no more comments on the SCO issue, we'll go ahead and take a quick break. And we will come back on the other side of the break and talk with our guests, from Real Networks. This is really exciting, having Real Networks. We've been wanting to have Real Networks on our show for a long time. A converted company, a company that used to be a non-participant in open source, but somebody, a company that really finally believes in what we're doing out here is the right way to go. If nothing else, at least for industry standards, it's the only intelligent way to go. But we'll take a short break. Kevin, put on a tune. We'll be back in about 2 or 3 minutes, everybody. This has been the Linux Show, first half of,
I'd like to
for
March
the 10th, or is it the 11th already?
11th.
The Linux Show possible.
2003, we'll be right back.
VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
Although I've never been to Rio, there's nothing saying to me go, 'cause there's a chance I just might find my diplomats there, Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow I may fly to Rio to find the love I need to know. Someone is waiting for me somewhere, and it could be Rio de Janeiro. My Brazilian, are you only one man waiting in a million? It's an obvious I'm so willing. I can't keep much time, I need to find you now. Show me how to get to Rio. I need some space to just unwind. There is a real thing that is real, but for Rio, it's possibly a state of mind. my one and only theme. There'll be some time to spend in Rio. I feel it's not too far away. And I will hear the samba playing and the music. You'll be all that they say that you love me. Let my surprise be here. And return and touch me. Chances are you won't speak Castilian. Or be Brazilian. But it's a hard man for the watch. Cause if I never get to Rio,
this is part two of the Linux Show for March 11th, 2003. We have a guest tonight. We have a guest every Tuesday night. Russ, I'll let you do the intros. So take it away.
Okay. Our guest tonight is Rob Lanfear, who is the Helix Community Manager and Grand Poobah of the helixcommunity.org website, which has to do with the Helix DNA project. Now, those may be new names for a lot of the people listening at the moment, but if we happen to mention that things like Real Player and some names that we know very well enter into all of this, this is not new stuff inside some sense at all. So how are you doing tonight, Rob?
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for coming by.
You bet.
So what is this Helix DNA project all about, pray tell?
Well, the Helix DNA project, actually the Helix initiative as a whole, is broken down into three components. We have the Helix DNA, which is the core platform, which is basically the engine for our client, server, and producer products that come from Real Networks. There's the Helix Community, which is the website and collaboration environment that we use to collaborate on further development of the Helix DNA. And then there's the Helix Platform, which is and Helix product line, which we which Real Networks sells for use by commercial entities. And so it's really all three of those things. The Helix DNA engine is all three components. The client end, which is the engine for the Real One player, the server end, which is the engine for what's now called our Helix Universal Server, formerly known as Real Server, and the producer, the Helix DNA producer, which is the core engine for our Helix producer.
All right. So let me ask the question that I'm sure someone's thinking right now. Is this really open source? I mean, are you really doing an open source thing here, or is this some sort of shared source hocus pocus that's going on?
No, it is real. It is genuine open source, and we recently, about a month ago, received certification from the Open Source Initiative for the license, one of the two licenses that the Helix DNA is licensed under, the RPSL, which is an acronym standing for the Real Networks Public Source License. We also have a license. All of the code is dually licensed, so it's under the RPSL or optionally under the RCSL, which is the Real Networks Community Source License. That license is more for commercial entities, and it's modeled after Java's Sun Community Source License.
Are either one of those licenses either one of those licenses received the blessing of the Free Software Foundation?
We've been in discussions with the Free Software Foundation, and It's been very encouraging, the discussions that we've been having. But I don't think they're yet prepared to say that it's that it's a free license. They haven't said either way on their website.
Well, that's good. At least it's partially good. you have to understand the Free Software Foundation holds pretty strong current in our industry and in the open source industry, and being GPL compatible surely would be advisable.
Sure. GPL compatibility is pretty tough without being GPL, actually. So,
well, that's not true. I mean, there's lots of Apache is. And
let me revise that statement. The RPSL is a copyleft style license.
It is.
So it behaves very similarly to the GPL in many scenarios. And so there's not very many examples that you can name of copyleft GPL compatible licenses that are not the GPL. It's very hard to do.
Well, it's all GPL.
Right, exactly.
So what's actually out there and usable as far as this project's concerned? If some of our listeners wanted to try to download some things and play with it, what would they find out on that website right now?
We're still in the early days, but basically the things that you can play with right now, we provide both source and binaries for all three projects. On the client side, you're going to find the client engine is out there, along with a couple of sample applications that for example, let you play things from the command line. And of course, I'm not listening to the show right now on my computer, but I was just seeing on IRC that one of the guys is actually listening to this show using that client, using the Helix DNA client that's available off the website. And that includes the source code support for a lot of standards-based codecs, as well as binary plugins for Real Audio and Real Video.
Mm.
The state of affairs on the client side. On the server side, it's a very similar story. There's, if you want pure open source, the server streams MP3s today, and then with the binary plugins, you get support for Real Audio, Real Video as well. And on the producer side, we encode Ogg Vorbis as an audio codec in pure open source form, and then Real Audio and Real Video plugins there as well. And we're going to be, over the next year, we're going to be expanding the list of codecs that are available for the platform.
Oh, that's tremendous. Where did this whole project come from? I mean, for years, those of us who've been inside the Linux community for a while, we've been used to the binary releases of RealPlayer and some other things that have gone on in the past. But what prompted you folks to actually start opening the code?
Well, it was a combination of things. There was a number of folks inside of Real Networks who have always been fans of open source, myself included, who long advocated doing something along these lines. So there's been that constant awareness of open source internally. But then, in addition to that, there's been a lot of industry dynamics that have taken hold over the past, just in the past year alone, where not only has there been increased interest and deployment of open source applications, but just from a practical perspective, in some of the markets that we're most interested in, for example, in embedded clients, so both mobile clients like cell phones and that sort of thing, and set-top boxes and pretty much any non-PC device. There's been substantial interest for open source. Combine that with the fact that we, in looking at how many different platforms that we would have to port our software to, we realized that we would need to get that source code out there in one form or another and collaborate with our partners in the industry on that source code, that we couldn't just keep it in-house and do it all of our all ourselves. So that was one of the big motivating factors in all of this, was just that the proliferation of devices and different platforms to port our clients to, our servers to, our producers to, it just got to be a pretty immense list, and we could no longer be in the position of picking the winners, basically deciding, okay, for example, Kerbango is going to be the next big thing or whatever, right? We actually did some work with the Kerbango and then watched as that project got scrapped. So those are the kinds of things that that we wanted to avoid, was being in that position to have to pick and choose which things win and which things lose.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you have some binary plugins and things. Which things are you keeping closed source, and what's the rationale behind that?
Well, there's a number of pieces that, either from a practical perspective or a licensing perspective, we've not released. So on the client side, we haven't released the Real Audio and Real Video plugins for playback of audio and video. Those pieces, there's a combination of factors. It's one of the biggest reasons is they're not necessarily ours to give out. We've, over the years, what people think of as Real Audio and Real Video are actually a pretty broad suite of codecs that include things that have been either developed in-house or with the help of third parties, or just flat-out licensed from third parties as well. So in many respects, we don't necessarily have the latitude to open source that stuff. So that's one of the motivating factors there. The what we call the top level client, which is basically the Chrome surrounding the media playback engine, is something that we haven't open sourced. And actually, to be candid, it was in some ways an artifact of what our organizational structure was once upon a time. It was there were pieces of it that didn't make sense to open source. That, you know, things have changed around, and now maybe it does make sense. So we haven't necessarily released everything that we're going to release. So that's pretty much all I'll say on that front. So that's the way that things break down on the client. On server and producer, things work very similarly. It's Real Audio and Real Video that we're the codecs themselves that we're not keeping or that we're not releasing, and the protocol handling for the chit chat between the client and server with respect to the codecs.
Okay, now I can just imagine some software developer somewhere who's saying, "How the heck are you going to make money when you're, you know, giving away at least part of the family jewels here? How is Real Networks going to thrive as a business based on all this open source software? What's the plan?"
Well, in many ways, it's the same way that we always have. We basically got a pretty broad business that entails not only the sale of software, though certainly that's a pretty substantial portion of our business, but we've always had a very substantial support business and professional services business and those things, and those are going to continue to be there. And in fact, this initiative has created whole new opportunities on those fronts as well.
I'd like to break in. I got a couple of really good questions from the IRC chat room that I'd like you to address before we go too far away and I forget them, to be honest with you. But there's a couple really excellent questions. One of them is, historically, there's always been a problem, regardless of the media player you're talking about, be it RealPlayer, QuickTime, Microsoft's media player, whatever you're talking about, there's always been a distribution issue where there was no media player out there that was just totally free for people to distribute, regardless of whether it's open source or non-open source, so that people could do things like include the player on a CD for media. Do you have plans of doing things like that with the Helix project?
Well, we've actually, it's always been possible for folks, like if you want to include it on hard media and that sort of thing, there's an agreement that you can get off of our website right now for the full-on Real One player. You can download a PDF, and it's a pretty simple agreement where...
Is that true with soft media as well?
What's that?
Is that true with soft media as well?
With soft media?
Yeah. Like website downloads.
Website downloads are a little bit different, but for hard media, the downloads exist there, or excuse me, agreement exists there. The soft media, you pretty much have to come back to Real Networks and have a special arrangement. It's not as simple as grabbing a PDF off the website.
Okay, and is that then following back into Russ's question of is this part of your long-term financial strategy?
Well, it's certainly been the case that our a substantial portion of our business has been bringing traffic towards our website, specifically because we provide not only software but content as well through our Real One subscription service. And so, it's becoming a more substantial part of our business as time moves on. So, certainly, it's the case that we're a little more protective of our of that particular business than we are of the hard goods distribution. But regardless, with the Helix initiative, we're of course there's many other ways to get the software as well. The pieces that we have released are open source. So clearly there's no distinction between soft distribution and hard distribution there. It's pretty much whatever you want to do for distribution.
Okay. How about in the case of other types of either product or codec, are you doing any reaching out to people like Macromedia or Apple to attempt to make them aware of what you're doing with Helix, or perhaps we might see a ability to do QuickTime or Flash within the Helix client?
Well, certainly we have the as far as QuickTime goes, we've both QuickTime and Flash, we've got support for those formats inside the Helix Universal server and inside the Real One player. As far as providing some sort of open source solution for those, both companies are aware of our initiative, but they've not chosen to release. In the case of Apple, there's no open source client distribution that I'm aware of there. Mac Media does have an open source Flash renderer, and that's something that we've that's an interesting possibility. The Flash code that we've gotten is not based on that particular implementation, so there's it gets a little bit complicated with regards to Flash as far as providing that on the client side. But as I was saying before, we support those in our Helix Universal line. So,
how do you propose to handle the digital rights management issues in open source?
Fine question. So
that's from our good friend David Mooring in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that we have a DRM solution that's not open source, and really there's not much that you can do in terms of providing both. A completely open source DRM solution, you know, just because by its very nature, unless you're willing to give up the notion that it's bulletproof, watertight, whatever, then you really can't publish the source code for it because it is based on not being able to see that stuff. So,
PPG to evidence to the contrary. It seems like there's plenty of security things that are completely open technology, which use their algorithmic nature to obscure instead of obscurity to obscure, like the RSA trapdoor.
Sure. Although the way that typical cryptographic security works is basically to prevent eavesdroppers in the middle of a conversation between two endpoints. So it's a very different situation than the point at which you're trying to have one of the endpoints trying to limit what one of the endpoints can do with the unencrypted data, in essence. So it's a very different situation.
Well, yeah. I believe one can make an argument either way, but that's one of the issues that certainly has to be addressed sometime. And I'm wondering what maybe real networks could be part of it, since they seem to be going down the open source path. Maybe that's something that they ought to look into, because certainly digital rights management by obscurity isn't going to work. Because that involves inevitably leaning on something like the DMCA or something to enforce your digital rights for you, rather than having the technology inherent in the technology, for instance.
So I suppose let me turn the question around. Is my understanding of the way that the open source community has handled DRM traditionally has just flat out come out against it, and so I'm wondering, is there work going on an open source DRM? I'm personally not aware of anything along those lines.
Nor am I. Yeah, and this is highly speculative. So it's just that if the entertainment industry is going to have digital rights management, it seems to me that by doing it by obscurity is just not going to work, and that it's always going to be somebody that cracks it. And the only way to do it is possibly with some, and it's been cracked time and time again.
I think that the thing that that is potentially a very interesting angle to pursue. Is some combination of, writes metadata. So, for example, just being able to say that, express what one's rights are as a licensee, or, you know, as a copyright licensee inside of a, in a mechanical way. So, let me give you an example of how that might manifest itself even in the world of open source, which is that, let's say that there was some metadata associated with, some machine-readable metadata associated with source code files, so that you could see which source code files were BSD licensed versus GPL versus anything in a machine-readable way, and have some sort of way of expressing the differences between GPL and BSD and LGPL and RPSL and all of these different formats, different types of licenses. And then as a compile time or whatever, link time, what you name it, exercise, actually have your compiler tell you whether or not you're actually unintentionally violating the license by combining two incompatible licenses, for example.
I shudder to think.
I mean, because it is a practical problem where somebody doesn't necessarily, where the software doesn't necessarily have to enforce that license so much as, because certainly somebody could just hack right around it, so, you know, change what the license is in the file. But just being informed in a way that is very clear and non-ambiguous.
Well, that sounds like a very simple thing to do. I mean,
no,
all you have to do is have a meta string in your source file say that I am a GPL, I am a BSD, I am an Apache, I am an whatever yours is, and then just have a bunch of dependencies. But I don't think this addresses DRM. I mean, you know, the reason why our industry is so vehemently against digital rights management is that all previous attempts to control intellectual property rights using technological things like DRM, I might cite the copy protection schemes of the 1980s, have been an abysmal failure.
So many smart 12-year-olds around.
Yeah, and they will do it every single time.
Sure, there's... are you familiar with Lawrence Lessig's Creative Commons project?
Yeah.
So one of the things that's interesting with that particular project is this concept of, you know, mix and matching the different terms associated with content. So just being able to say, hey, look, I want attribution, and I require attribution, and just being able to clearly mark content in that regard is something that, you know, if it's not necessarily a coercive system, but one that is an informative and helpful system, can be very useful.
I agree. That's Lessig is trying to solve a problem. But
we're rapidly running out of time here, and I got a couple of quick questions I want to get out there. Number one is, a lot of people are unaware of the fact that Real, as a company, and probably Glazer as an individual, your CEO, played a pretty important role in at least temporarily not solving the problem of CARP, but at least coming up with a temporary solution for a number of those small radio stations that were doing webcasting. So taking that into consideration, that you're in the business of making this Helix open source product, providing the servers, the producers, the clients, there are other issues that are out there that are facing people that are streaming media other than just the ability to take a file and wrap a codec around it and push it out onto a wire. What I'm getting at is the needs for a diversity of competent tools that will allow businesses and individuals who want to do webcasting to stay within the laws. And so are you putting any thought at all, in terms of the Helix project, into starting up some people working on content tracking tools, reporting tools, things like that, that people who really want to live within the rules of BMI ASCAP could then have their little webcasting company at home? Are you doing any work in that area at all?
Well, this is sort of outside of my realm of expertise here. I'm more on the software side of the house. Certainly there's some interesting ideas there, and you know, some possibilities for tools that would be great to have out there in the community. And certainly those are great things to chip in on Helix community as well. These are the sort of discussions that we'd love to continue on the mailing list there. I think that what we're doing on the subscription side of our business, where we've got we're working with a lot of the big companies, but we've also got services that we offer to small companies for providing content as well. We've got the what's called our OpenPath service, which allows somebody to license their content as part of our larger subscription service. And so and we take care of all of the back-end accounting and that sort of thing. So we have some of that in place, but certainly tools and that sort of thing. If you have ideas for exactly how that would manifest itself, we'd love to continue that conversation.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, I do. That's why the question interests me. Being the fact that we're webcasters, we're sort of preoccupied with those issues, and we get a lot of the correspondence in the mail of why we haven't paid this particular fee or that particular fee, and we have to justify our reasons why we're paying some fees and not paying other fees. So tracking that information is a pain in the ass, but it's really important to staying in business legally.
I can imagine.
Okay, well, we are up to half past the hour, so it's time to shut down for the evening. Rob, it was a pleasure having you on, and unfortunately I was hoping we could actually link you up. I was trying to get Doc to call Rob Glazier and get him to join us too. We've been meaning to have him on the show for quite some time. It would have been fun to have your CEO sort of drop it on you, but maybe next time. Again, thanks again for stopping by. And
great, thanks for having me.
We're looking very much forward to seeing what Helix has coming down the pike.
Yeah, I think there's some exciting things in the
let's see, lots of clients.
Yeah, lots of clients.
We want clients.
A hybrid, think of this, a hybrid media player IM client.
Yeah, one that streams real that isn't real player. Because, real player can be a little bit cumbersome.
Well, we're certainly, the code's all there for somebody to build that, and you're probably not going to see us do something that's not real player, but if you don't like the idea of having a real bubble on your player.
Oh, I don't mind the real bubble. Real player is just a little bit cumbersome. Of course, you do interface with a lot of the audio systems now, and a lot of my complaints about Real Player in the past have gone away. But
I encourage you to if you haven't seen our the Real One Player for the Macintosh. Take a look at that.
Will do.
I think it's definitely a model of things to come.
Well, great. And on behalf of the whole crew here, I want to tell all the listeners out there to once again thank you for stopping by for the regularly scheduled weekly edition of the Linux Show. A little housekeeping. We will be back next week. Russ, who is our guest next week? It's Cooper. I'm trying to remember his last name.
Oh, give me 1 second and I'll get it for you. Cooper Stevenson,
and we're going to be talking about the first of a number of open source legislation initiatives that are going on in the statewide level. This is a prototype, a template for many, many future things to come. We think this is going to be a very exciting show. For those of you listening, make sure you contact your local politicians and get them to listen to this show, because not only are we going to have Cooper, but hopefully we will have the author of the legislation as well, and he can provide copies of the legislation to other legislators, be it in other states or even in other countries. In addition to our guest next week, I want to remind everybody that there is a little section on the front page of the Linux Show website, of course, www.thelinuxshow.com. A couple of links to keep in mind. The first link is our registration partnership that is providing some badly needed revenues for to pay our phone bill. So if you want a domain name or you need to renew a domain name, whatever, if we got the domains cheap and it helps finance the Linux Show. In fact, we're going to have a special announcement shortly, within the next few days, for sure by next week's show time, where we're going to be doing a 2-for-1 registration deal, where you register a domain for like $7 or $8, and you're going to get the second domain free. It's going to be a pretty good deal. And
my schizophrenic friend will love that.
Yeah. But, and of course, all the proceeds of our registration partner go to support the Linux Show. There's also information there of a PayPal link where you can give us a donation. Thanks to Stock out there. Stock, just for those of you who are in the IRC, you know who Stock is. Stock is the official sponsor for all of March. What a guy. He has graciously given us a donation that has underwritten our telephone bill for the entire month of March. So thanks, Stock. It's really helpful. We appreciate the support of our listeners. So keep it up, everybody. Make sure you tell 10 friends. Let's grow this crowd every week. So everybody, come on back. We'll see you next week.
The home of sweet romance. It wins you at a glance. Gives happy feet a chance to dance.
Your form
is like a clinging vine.
Your lips,
the warm and sweet as wine.
Your cheeks,
the soft and close to mine.
Dear
Mama, my heart is sweet. While the band is sweet, never try to rock them. Stop them with you.
What's on?
A perfect holiday.
Savon.
Where we can glide and sway.
Savon.